Meeting the House Civil Law Committee will come to order. Do I have a motion on the minutes from February 1st?
So moved.
All in favor of the minutes from February 1st signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. First bill on the calendar, Representative Hortman, are you ready to go?
I am ready to go.
Okay. And as you've been made aware, Representative Hillstrom has requested this bill. So we're sending it to Judiciary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed.
I would move House File 278 be recommended to pass and referred to Judiciary Policy and Finance.
Thank you, Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, I have with me today Michelle Timmons, the reviser of statutes, and I will let her explain the bill because she understands it much better than I do.
Thank you. Ms. Timmons, please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Michelle Timmons, the reviser of statutes for the state of Minnesota. And as one of my duties as I became reviser is also to serve on the Uniform Law Commission. And in that capacity, I actually was the chair of the Uniform Law Commission drafting committee for this act, the Uniform Electronic Legal Material Act, or UELMA. And so I did prepare just a one-page handout to summarize my testimony today. And I guess the first thing I wanted to tell you is I think there's a lot of both local and national support for this act. It's very strongly supported by the American Association of Law Libraries, the local chapter of that organization, the Minnesota Association of Law Libraries, supports the act. And I see in the audience Liz Reppy, our new state law librarian, who's here today in support of the act as well. The act was approved exactly 1 year ago by the American Bar Association. I hope that's a good omen. It was enacted. There were two state enactments last year in the states of Colorado and California. And this year there have been four other introductions in addition to Minnesota and Connecticut, Hawaii, Massachusetts, and North Dakota. And I'm anticipating that there may be more states as well that will enact this act. So last year it was introduced in Minnesota, and it actually passed the House 133-0, but it was a short session and we did not get a Senate hearing. And so we are back this year. Representative Hortman is carrying the bill in the House with co-authors Representatives Earhart and Scott, and in the Senate, Senator Latz, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, is serving as the chief author. So, as drafted for Minnesota, the legal material covered by the act is really the most important state-level legal material with the force and effect of law. So that's the Minnesota Constitution, the session laws, the Minnesota statutes, and the administrative rules. And because those four publications are already today published by the Reviser's Office, the office that I head, is the only legal publisher affected by the act as we've drafted it today. And so once the act is enacted, what it will require the official publisher to do is really three main things. One, to provide authenticated legal material. So provide a method to determine that what you as the user are seeing on that screen is the authentic material that we as the official publisher published. So it really deals with security measures to protect that information in the transition between the publisher to the user of the material. We also must preserve the legal material for the long term and provide long-term public access to it. So I think there's a lot of good news here because the revisor's office has already done a beta version of authenticated administrative rules, and the URL is right there on the one-page handout if you want to check it out. And we've been able to authenticate the administrative rules without the purchase of any commercial software. It's an entirely in-house developed method that we're using our existing software and hardware and existing staff resources to effectuate that. So by the January 1, 2015 effective date, what we'll do is take that beta version for the administrative rules and apply that program also to the Constitution, the Minnesota statutes, and the session laws. And we're working on a plan for long-term preservation. We're actually working with the Minnesota History Center and the University of Minnesota on that. We just, even today, have, I hope, good backup plans in that we send backup tapes well to a place in Coon Rapids. We actually send them periodically out of state. After I watched Katrina, I decided that keeping backup tapes just in Minnesota wasn't really the a complete long-term preservation plan. So we even send some tapes out of state. And we have daily backup tapes over at the Park Street building where the revisor's computer staff are housed. So we kind of have a triple deep layer of backup systems now, and we want to make that even more robust. Then what we'll do is we'll declare that the electronic versions that you see online, and specifically the PDFs that can be authenticated, are just as official for use in Minnesota as the book versions are today. And because we've developed this in-house system, we will be able to absorb the costs of providing the authentication in the revisor's office budget. And as I've testified, we already need to provide for the backup and preservation, so that also is already built into the budget. And I think, though, because we have developed an in-house low-cost way to provide authentication, Minnesota really has an opportunity to provide some national leadership in this area. Most of the other states and the federal government printing office that has provided leadership on this issue nationally has purchased commercial software to be able to do the same thing that we're doing with our in-house version. So I'm anxious to get that model, a low-cost, homegrown model out there to provide a path for other states, and hope that we can spur enactment across the country.
Thank you. Ms. Timmons, questions from members of the committee? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Timmons, is there a fiscal note on this?
There is not a fiscal note, and if there was one, it would say that the costs are going to be absorbed in the revisor's budget.
Representative Scott? Okay. Other questions? Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having some experience with homegrown programs in the fire service, that when the resident expert that developed the program retired and left, we ended up having to redo our whole system and go out and buy programs because it failed after he left and couldn't keep the thing going. And that's my concern, is as hardware and software continues to evolve and we continue to change, how do we know that those formats that we're going to save this material in are going to be accessible in the future?
Ms. Timmons?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Howe. I think that is one of the main issues that was that was discussed, actually, when this act was drafted. And it's part of the reason that there is language in the act that requires outcomes. The outcome is you have to be able to authenticate the material and preserve it for long-term public access. It doesn't say how. And part of the reason why is because we anticipate those methods will change over time. And so the act was drafted to be flexible, to be able to change the methods as necessary in the future. But the reality is that we do need to preserve this material. We recently did a project to scan all the old Minnesota statutes, and we missed some. One book, and I got not one but two different inquiries, one from a private lawyer, one from a housing court referee, asking where the 1891 statutory material was because it was necessary for their research. So the reality is this is something that I think we must do, particularly as we go to electronic legal material. Now, getting back more to the specific, the earlier part of your question was, you know, sometimes with homegrown systems, then if the person who developed the system leaves, retires, whatever, then you have to totally replace it. I think part of the beauty of what we've developed is it's pretty simple. There's a system that of hashing, it's called hashing or providing hash algorithms for material in an electronic document. And that was actually developed quite early in the infant days of the internet when people weren't sure that they'd gotten the whole document at the other end of the pipeline. And so what we're doing is we're providing a unique hash algorithm for each PDF that we have in our database. And so I think it's, even though it's homegrown, it's a pretty, for a technological system, it's a pretty long-term tried and true method, and it's pretty simple. In fact, nationally, the National Archives was quite excited about it because it's simple, it has some utility to be able to use that hash again in the preservation, the long-term preservation, so that if you do have to migrate something into a new format, you'll be able to run that hash and make sure you got all the underlying data.
Representative Howe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. So I guess what I'm concerned about, mm-hmm. if I'm running, if it was saved in, mm-hmm. and I'll just pick out Word 95, and all of a sudden you're running Word 2007, mm-hmm. and I know when I bring up some documents, I end up with different asterisks and different mm-hmm. pieces that now the document looks totally different from what its original state is. So are we going to have to continually upgrade and save this document as we go, or once it's saved in that mm-hmm. format, and then we have the challenge to bring that forward?
Ms. Timmons?
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Howe, you're absolutely right. We may have to migrate into other formats, electronic formats, and that's really part of the preservation plan that we're working on with the Historical Society and the U of M. I mean, by having the document in fundamentally in an XML format as well as PDF, having it saved in different formats, I think helps with the migration. Having that unique hash value that allows us to check the integrity of the migration if we do have to migrate it to another format, I think that helps. The fact that we do, we are continuing to print books at this time so that we will have some print backup so that if we had to rescan it into a new format, we could do that. All those items are part of the preservation plan. But, I mean, the questions you're asking are exactly the right ones.
Nice job, Representative Howe. Any other questions from members of the committee? I ask a note from members that this seems kind of heady and maybe irrelevant for some of them, but driving home last night, I did hear on the radio how they preserved documents from Timbuktu that was looted and libraries that were burned, and they had some pretty creative ways to do that, which may seem irrelevant, but many of these manuscripts are absolutely critical in researching certain aspects of history. When I first ran for office, I had to go dig into archives at the Minnesota Historical Society, find out the terms of how I ran as a prosecutor and were there any limitations on running for office. And that was kind of before anything was on the Internet, or before everything was on the Internet 10 years ago. And so I had to search through there, and it was really relatively difficult to find. But I found it, and it was because someone had gone out of their way to ensure that all these things are meticulously preserved. So thank you, Ms. Timmons, for working with us. Thank you, Representative Hortman, for bringing it through. And if there's no other questions from members of the committee, do you have any final comments, Representative Portman?
No, Mr. Chair, except for that I think we maybe found a use for Yucca Mountain. We can preserve all the tape from the Minnesota legislature.
God bless America. That said, the motion remains before the committee that House File 278 be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy, because some of this stuff could end up in court someday, I think is the reason. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you very much, Ms. Timmons. Thank you, Representative Portman. Next item on the calendar is we have Judge Janice Redding from the 4th District Family Court, who was good enough to come down and give us an overview on family law procedures. And the reasons for this, members, and I really want to thank Judge Redding for being down here. This committee does handle family law issues. Some of the matters can be arcane, and oftentimes what committee members will hear is the heated arguments, and sometimes it's difficult to see the forest for the trees because the arguments are the trees, and we got an obligation to see the entire forest in this committee. So. Judge Redding is going to give us an overview on that. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Redding. Please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Janice Redding. I'm the presiding judge in the family court in the 4th Judicial District, which is Hennepin County. I'm pleased to talk to you about family law. I get to talk to a lot of people about family law, but not in this circumstance before, so thank you for having me. Do you have the PowerPoint now? Great, we lost it and now it's here, so great. Everyone is getting one, I think. I just want to give you an overview of what we do in family court. We do it a little differently in different areas of the state. In Hennepin County, we have a tremendous volume, so we have judges that are dedicated to family court, as in Ramsey County. But most of the judges throughout the state do family court mixed in with the rest of the court's business. Sorry. Not very good technologically, so this would be a major feat if I'm able to do this. As you can see from the major case filings, the last year that we had up to date was 2011. 24% of the cases that are filed in the courts in Minnesota are family court cases. We think that's really important because we know that that means that most of our citizens are law-abiding. They don't see the courts very often, and the people who see it on that rare occasion are people who are probably coming through family court on some family law related matter. So it's important that those people get good service and that they have a good overall impression of our court. So we think these cases are really important for that reason and because we're dealing with people's personal lives on such a personal level. Out of the almost 49,000 filings in family court, about 35% combined are the dissolutions with children and without children. So about a third of what we see are dissolutions. Another 32% are child support cases. That includes paternity cases, which are often brought in the child support system. And then I think this is the surprising number to me, always domestic abuse, that 22% of what we see are domestic abuse cases. I think that's just tremendously high. I don't know why our filings are that high again this year. I don't think we're making very good progress on that that issue in society, I think that's a surprisingly high number. Family law cases overall have stayed pretty steady over the years. There's a little bit of a dip in 2007. That's when the child support statute changed, and there was a slight moratorium on modification motions in child support. So that's the dip in 2007. Otherwise, we stay pretty steady in family law filings. In terms of Court of Appeal filings, family law only makes up about 10% of the appellate court filings. So I know that you folks in your job get lots of complaints usually from people in family law cases, but the reality is that the actual overall appellate filings are quite a bit lower than the district court filings. So the number of people who take those cases on appeal is smaller. We, as a presiding judge in the 4th District, I get a lot of complaints from various people who have had cases before different judicial officers in my district. I deal with those, and we certainly let people know that appeal is our ultimate avenue. I don't have the authority to overrule another judge's decision, but I certainly can let people know what their rights to appeal are. And then with Supreme Court filings, family law is down to about 5% of the overall cases filed in the Supreme Court. I think part of the reason for this is that in the very end of 2010, beginning of 2011, they started the Family Appellate Mediation Project. There was a realization that the cases that went to family law appeals are really they're the toughest cases. You know, this is kind of the wheat and the chaff being separated as these cases move up. And the cases that get to appeal are really tough cases. So they started this mediation project where there's a mandatory mediation for family court cases that go on appeal. And unless they're exempted for good cause shown, everybody has to mediate their case. And I'm not sure what the current rate is, but it's about 50% of those cases resolve in that family court mediation project. So we consider that to be highly successful, that many people are able to get their issues resolved and not have to go that next litigious step, but get things resolved and their families can get back to living their lives as opposed to being engaged in litigation. At the district court level, we have the judges who are most of the people who hear family law cases in both Ramsey and Hennepin, and I think it's Maurer. There's another district that has Susan Chambers. She's a pretty new referee who's doing family court cases. But the referees are sort of a sub-judge. They are judicial officers who hear one area of the law. So our referees in family law hear just family law cases. They don't hear criminal like the judges. They don't hear juvenile. They don't hear other cases. So we rely on them very heavily as our subject matter experts. The majority of them were family law practitioners. They have lots of extensive family law experience. And they really are the experts that the judges rely on, as the judges sort of hear all kinds of different cases and can't become a complete expert in one area. The referees really do that for us. In the 4th District, we have 6 out of our 15 judicial officers are referees. Then we have the child support magistrates. They hear just the child support related cases. And again, statewide, they're through the state child support office, not appointed through the courts. Out of the
Judge Rennie, can you tell me, is the appeal from the decision of a referee the same as it is for other types of jurisdictions short of district court, so straight de novo consideration?
It is, yes.
Okay, thank you.
The types of cases that we hear, divorces are, as you saw, the biggest single case type with and without children. We hear all kinds of divorce cases. I think a lot of people, probably you folks especially, the legislation you see is probably more related to, that comes up kind of continually, is child issues. But we do a lot of financial issues too. We have significant financial issues that we deal with in every single dissolution. And then, of course, the child-related issues. Domestic orders for abuse, as I said, those are the civil equivalent of a no-contact order or a similar thing. We have hearings on those. That takes up a considerable amount of our time, domestic abuse orders for protection. And we think it's one of the most important things we do, and we think we're keeping people safe by devoting a considerable amount of time to those.
Thank you, Judge. Representative Scott, you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Judge Redding, do you ever see an overlap in the orders for protection, and do those ever coincide with the dissolution with children? That seems to be something that I hear a lot about is that's one way to kind of, you know, make an accusation and get an order for protection, and that works for or against someone, either parent, in the case of a custody issue.
Judge Brady?
Sure, we do see that. We see it pretty frequently. And I think that it's not always clear to us. Sometimes it's clear, but not always clear, if the order for protection is a legitimate request for an order for protection, or if there's, I think probably what you're getting at, some attempt to get a leg up in the custody proceedings. Pretty typically, that is fleshed out pretty quickly in the custody proceeding. And I teach judges statewide on how to do these kinds of things, and one of the things I always recommend to them, and I think they're probably doing most of the time, is that if an order of protection case comes in, it's heard, that usually in terms of custody and parenting time, that the judge will make some temporary custody and parenting time provisions, but then defer those ultimate determinations to the family court judge who's hearing the family court case, so that that person can have more time and more thought and more consideration to what the ultimate custody and parenting time terms will be. The order for protection comes in very quickly. It's on an expedited time frame. We hear those hearings within 2 weeks. You know, they get a half an hour, an hour. Well, we can't do anything in depth in terms of custody and parenting time, so we generally defer that to the family court case so that there's more in-depth look at that.
Representative Scott.
Thank you.
Representative Pugh.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Judge Redding. I have a question with regard to this order of protection. Wondering about the parent who is on the losing end of the determination about this, and if there is a statute of limitations as to, you know, when that could be reconsidered based on new evidence or an appeal from the parent who, you know, was on the losing end.
Judge Redding?
Thank you. And I just want to ask for clarification. When you say losing end, are you talking about on the losing end of having an order of protection entered against them or a
yes.
custody determination?
Perfect. Yes, an order for protection against them, because you mentioned that this determination is made early on.
Right.
Judge Redding.
Thank you. When they come in and ask for an order of protection, it sort of depends on if they're seeking an order of protection on their own behalf or on behalf of the children also. I think a fair amount of the ones that are brought on behalf of the children, I don't think people are necessarily bringing these with the thought that they're trying to get something that they're not entitled to for the children, but I think a fair number of those are the children are dismissed from the petition. In my experience, a fair number of the children ultimately are dismissed. They aren't found to be a victim of abuse, and they're dismissed from the petition. So in that way, the child is not a protected party under the petition, and then we're just making normal custody and parenting time decisions. If an order is granted and it is on behalf of, let's say, the parent and the child, then that's automatically enforceable, and the Court of Appeals is their avenue for relief from that. But the custody and parenting determinations that we're making in those actions are always reviewable immediately in the family court file.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Judge Redding, good morning. Sorry we've got a chair between us here. But I'm sure you know that this issue about what happens in custody determinations is a hot topic here at the legislature. And I'm just intrigued. I wasn't going to stop you, but since we're stopping for questions, I hope this is okay. I don't want to pull you too off track. But going back to your original slides about the number of appeals in different areas of the law, and you noted that there are fewer in terms of the portion of appeals that are in family cases is lower than the overall portion of cases. And I'm wondering, you seem to draw a conclusion from that people were generally not as dissatisfied in that area or something like that. And I'm wondering if there's any data about if you were to break out the family cases by the income level of the participants, in other words, or by do they have a private lawyer or not, if you would see the same kind of correlation. And where I'm going here is that I think a lot of times appeals are so expensive for people, and they oftentimes, even if they aren't indigent to begin with, they deplete a lot of resources going through the family court process if it's a really contested. And I'm just wondering if we have any data that shows whether, in fact, this is more correlated with your ability, your financial ability to appeal, than it is with the actual satisfaction. Because I know that in an area like, you know, child custody, often nobody's going to really be happy. I mean, we know that these are, by the nature of the cases, they are cases where people are, the rest of their lives, they may curse the court if they came out on what they consider the losing end. So is there any further breakout of that that we could actually really see if it's about the ability to appeal versus not caring to appeal?
Judge Redding.
I don't know. I don't know if there's any research been done. I don't know the answer to that. I do want to correct if I've made a misimpression. I certainly didn't mean to say, to imply that I think people are more satisfied than it appears. I mean, family law is a tough area. I really get that people, as you said, probably both sides are not satisfied, because unlike civil or criminal, there isn't a winner or a loser. Usually, in a case resolution, in a family law case, everybody's lost something, whether it's just the financial loss from having gone through it or whether it's been a significant loss in terms of the subject matter. I certainly understand that. But in answer to your question, I don't know the answer. I don't know if there's been any research done on that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Redding. Please proceed.
The other areas are, and what we spend a lot of our time on, as you would, I think, not be surprised, custody and parenting time. We see significantly more third-party custody cases where the person seeking custody is maybe a relative or an interested person. Paternity, child support, and contempt. I think we see fewer paternities because we have the recognition of parentage forms where people can voluntarily agree to paternity, but that just means that we tend to see more custody cases. It's sort of one or the other. The areas of law that we utilize in family court, I think it's a really interesting area to work in because we really use a broad area of different laws, and we have to have some knowledge in a lot of different areas, which makes it, I think, complicated and difficult for family court judges. We have to have a pretty good working knowledge of child development. What is good for parenting time or custody for a child who is 4 weeks old is probably very different than for a child who is 1 year or 3 years or 7 or 14. I have children, and any of you who have children are probably understand that kids' needs are different at those ages. Their developmental needs are different. Their psychological, emotional needs are different. So we have to have a pretty good working knowledge of that. We see significant mental health issues in parents and children, but really, truly, especially in parents. So we have to have a pretty good working knowledge of various mental health diagnoses, and I would include personality disorders. We see a significant amount of that. Again, I think no surprise that sometimes marriages break up because of various issues, and one of them is certainly mental health. Trauma is an interesting one. We see a lot of cases, as you know, we have a lot of immigrants, and we see a lot of people who have come from war-torn countries, or even people who come from violent areas of our cities and our state, and we see a lot of people with trauma, so we have to have a pretty good working knowledge of what reactions people have to trauma and the psychological problems that causes. Chemical dependency is a tremendously big issue. People used to ask me when I was a family law lawyer what I thought broke up marriages most, and I think they expected me to say money problems. And my opinion was then, and it still is, chemical abuse issues. Largely alcohol, but as you are aware, really significant alcohol and drug issues, and that's a tremendous factor that we have to deal with. So we have to understand dependency and what that does to families and how those kind of interactions happen. Domestic abuse, as I talked about a little earlier, a significant part of our caseload, so of course it's a significant part of what we see in our dissolution cases also. And then the financial issues, we have to have a pretty good working knowledge of real estate. that knowledge really changed in the last 5 or 6 years when the market changed. For a long time, we divided up people's assets, and that was lovely. And then the market flipped, and now we divide up people's debts. And we had to really learn about bankruptcy. We had to learn about houses underwater. We had to learn all new things. So now we have a different working knowledge of how to deal with dividing up debts and allocating minimal assets and minimal income sometimes to support two households that used to have to support one. Social Security, we see a lot of people who their main source of income or only source of income is Social Security. Obviously, tax law, pretty significant in terms of awarding spousal support and figuring out who gets what assets and how those will be taxed, things like that. The best interest of the child is kind of the overriding main consideration when we're talking about custody and parenting time. We know from all the social science that's been done, and I think intuitively we all know that children fare better when their parents are working together to negotiate custody and parenting time. And we know that children who, after a divorce is over, who live in less conflict fare better. They don't have the risks for the negative outcomes of those things that we all don't want our children to have. Criminal behavior, chemical dependency issues, promiscuity, things like that. Children in single-parent homes tend to be more at risk for those things, but the studies show us that those kids can turn out pretty well if the parents are not in conflict. So that's one of the main things we work on in family court, is to help parents resolve their conflict early and quickly, and have methods for conflict resolution as they move on after the dissolution. Most of the cases, the good news is, most of the cases we have settle. 95% of the cases we see settle. Sometimes it takes a little more work, a little more alternative dispute resolution, a little more help from us, but the reality is that most people are able to come to a settlement. So again, not surprising that the few cases that do go to trial that we see a lot are the most difficult cases. They have the most difficult issues, and they have the most difficult parties sometimes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is it possible, and this is kind of dovetailing on what Representative Liebling said, but just simply, is it possible that the reason that that settlement rate is so high is because people run out of resources or they basically give up?
Judge Redding.
I think that's possible. We have instituted lots of programs in our courts to assist people who don't have the resources so that they can get a fair resolution. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. Maybe I can even just move ahead to that. Yes, it's certainly possible, and I think some people, it can be a very difficult process for some people, but we have instituted things such as the early neutral evaluation and the case management. I'll just skip ahead a couple slides. We started probably about 12 years ago in the 4th District, what we called early case management. And at the time, it was... It's common sense now that we think about it, but at the time it was pretty revolutionary, where we took these cases at the beginning, and it's sort of a triage model, where we sat down with the parties, and instead of sitting down and having initially a request for temporary relief, which costs parties tons of money to have lawyers make affidavits, draft up memos of law, and sit down and have a hearing, and then we'd issue an order, and everything is... litigious from the beginning, we're at odds from the beginning. We sit down with people in what we call an initial case management conference. We sit down, you know, kind of like John is sitting near you across the table, and say, what are the issues here? Let's talk about what the issues are. Let's talk about what's not disputed and get that resolved and get that on the record. And then we'll figure out what to do with the disputed issues. Again, a triage model where we're just going to concentrate on those things that are at issue and use our funds for that, so the parties can use their funds in that directed way, and the courts can be much more efficient using their limited funds by just addressing what is actually the problem. So we sit down with people, and out of that comes our initial case conference order, which again sends people on different paths depending what the issues are and what we think is necessary to resolve them. We used to send cases for custody evaluation straight out of the gate a lot. We rarely do that anymore because we see that there are much better ways to resolve things, including giving parents who are able the most amount of input into deciding custody and parenting time arrangements for their children. I hope I'm answering your question. I'm probably going a little far afield, but
I have a separate question related to that. Back where you had the best interest of the child standard, how often do you have individuals, parties come to court where they had had an agreement, and then one or both of them lawyer up, and all of a sudden the agreement breaks down and it becomes more litigious, and you find yourself as a judge having to rein in the adversarial inclinations of the attorneys? How often do you see that?
I would say less and less. I would say not very often, number one, and less and less. When we started the case management and when we started things like early neutral evaluation 10 years ago or so, that was still a major problem. And it took a while to train the attorneys that that was not going to be the way we do business anymore. So we see that much less. We see attorneys now who fully embrace these programs, who see that they're better for kids and families, and they have come on board with us. There are still some out there who, in my opinion, are really litigious, but most of the attorneys have come on board with that, and sometimes these things come on where they do break down, but we can usually salvage that.
Yeah, thank you.
We work hard at salvaging those.
Oh, Representative Scott has another question.
Yeah, it's really more of a comment, and what makes me sad is that's the way that it was very often done way back when, and we've got a lot of families that have been harmed by that, and you know it's very difficult and expensive for those, you know, non-custodial parents or whatever to go back and have the courts reverse that and then so much time has been lost with their kids. So it's just more of a statement that it's just a very sad scenario that had to happen in the past, and I think it still does happen some, but just it's sad for the children because that really wasn't in their best interest.
Representative Simon.
Thanks, Judge. On the opposite end of that spectrum in terms of lawyering up, to what extent do you see people representing themselves? A lot of pro se litigants?
Judge Redd.
A tremendous amount of pro se litigants. That's in another part of my presentation also, but we estimate in our district it's probably about 65% of the litigants are not in family court are not represented by an attorney. That's a tremendous number. That makes our work pretty hard some days. I teach not just in our state but around the country dealing with unrepresented litigants because it is a different way to work and to deal with these cases. So we do have a lot who are not represented. Part of our job is to assist them to make sure that they, if they need a motion heard, they can get it filed and get it heard. And while we can't give them legal advice, we sometimes can assist in education or appointing them to a place where they can get some education to move their case along. Just at the bottom of this slide that I have up, I'll just talk a little bit more about the alternative dispute resolution programs that we've started. We started these for some of the reasons that Representative Scott mentioned, that we weren't doing very well at some of these things, and we realized it would do better. And the other important piece, and I think it's important, is that it was budget-driven also, that we knew it was too expensive to get cases through, both for the parties and the court, and we knew there were better ways to do it that cost less money. And some of the programs that were started were the Social Early Neutral Evaluation Program, and we have trained people statewide, and in fact, in many other states, our Minnesota trainers have gone out, and this is now being used in different places across the country, where people go in and meet with neutral evaluators. Instead of having a custody evaluator who did the big custody evaluation and came down with one final answer, people meet with neutral evaluators. They're able to share their concerns, both parties, and then the evaluators work with them to come up with a custody and parenting time plan. So it's sort of quasi-mediation. It's mediation with an evaluative component. We typically, they take about 2 to 3 hours, and they are resolving cases at about a 60 to 65% rate. So that's tremendous. Those are cases that used to go to trial, used to go to expensive custody evaluations, and now people are resolving those. The other thing we know is that if people resolve them on their own, if they're part of the process, and they are part of the decision-making, they are much happier with the outcome and much more likely to abide by the order. So it cuts down in post-decree hearings also, because people have been a part of that process and made that decision themselves, so they're willing to abide by it. That morphed into the financial early neutral evaluation. We use it less, but it's still really important, and important, I think, especially with people who have one or two important issues that they can't resolve. Maybe the issue is spousal maintenance, or maybe the issue is how to value a privately held business. And so people can go to the financial early neutral evaluator. Same thing, it's mediation with an evaluative component, and again, they have a tremendous result in coming to resolution on those kind of issues, so we don't see them in trial, and we tend not to see them back again post-decree. One thing that we're doing in the 4th District and hoping that maybe this will spread is the moderated settlement conference. It's sort of a late-stage neutral evaluation, where if we get people who are really close to trial and we think, gee, that, you know, if they can get this these one or two issues resolved, they will be able to conclude this case. It might be something as simple as the label on legal custody. I say simple, but of course that's not simple all the time. But we know that, and we can get people in a moderated settlement conference and work on that one issue. And again, we give them that one last chance to resolve the case. We think it's probably about 50%. We haven't started tracking these. We're working on a method for tracking these, but we think about 50% of those we are able to resolve right before trial. Thereby, you know, people don't have to have a trial. They don't have the expense of a trial. And again, they've been part of the solution, so they're more likely to be happy with the result. We also have in the 4th District a self-help center. People can walk in to the family court building, make an appointment with the self-help center, go in and get some limited legal advice and help filling out their forms. This has been expanded statewide. It's available statewide. Right now the statewide center is housed in the 4th District, but it's for everybody in the state. They have kiosks in the different law libraries statewide in the different counties where people can go in, sit down, work on a family law form, and if they have a trouble or they can't figure out what they're doing, they can pick up a phone, and it's a direct line to the statewide self-help center, so they can get help on filling out their form or asking some legal questions. They have law-trained people who work at the statewide self-help center to help people. So this is what we're doing for the self-represented parties who, as we noted, we have a tremendous number of these people who need a lot of assistance getting their issues resolved. And I think, again, this is kind of the bad old days. If you couldn't fill out the motion forms yourself or you couldn't figure out the process, tough luck. You didn't get into court. And we don't want that to happen. That's not good for kids. It's not good for parties. And we want people to get in and get their issues resolved and get their controversies resolved. So we've done a lot of work. I'm really proud of it. I don't have any reason to be proud of it because I didn't do any of it. But we really offer a tremendous service to people, both in our district and statewide, to be able to get into court, particularly when there are kids involved, and get these issues resolved. One thing I should talk about before I talk about the challenges facing family court, I think the other major initiatives that we have done is the e-filing, and you've probably heard a little bit about that, but in the last year, the family court in the 4th District went to e-filing. It was difficult, I would say, to take a lot of old dinosaur judges and move them to e-filing, and they do not have big piles of paper to hold anymore, and they had to give up that security blanket. But we now get our filings all electronically. When we want to review a case file, we pull up a laptop or a computer screen, and we go through the documents and review things. We sign orders electronically, so I bring up the order, I review it, and I have my electronic signature pad. So we are really working on that initiative so that we can have access with our partners, but also just it's a really time saver and money saver in the long run. We had a huge room in the basement where we stored our files. Those have all gone out for scanning and copying. We have now extra space, which the court will be able to use for other things. Just simple things like that have saved time and money for us. the challenges facing the family court, these are just my observations. I think probably my fellow judicial officers would agree with them, but they're the things that I think we have some of the most difficulty with. Obviously, the loss of funding is, as the state budget has been difficult, so has the court's budget. And there's been a loss of services, both the state-funded services, but also the private services that we used to rely on to send people there that are no longer there. I would say legal advice is one of the biggest ones. There used to be more groups that provided free or reduced cost, sliding fee scale legal advice, and obviously those have been cut tremendously. And the places that still do that, the Volunteer Lawyers Network, other places like that, they either have waiting lists or they've really cut what they can give to family law participants, particularly because it's such a big volume. That was a big part of their work, and they just don't have the capacity. Supervised parenting time is another one. We actually were really lucky in our district before. We actually had a supervised parenting time program. We know it's really important for kids to see their parents, even parents who aren't optimal parents. They're still parents of these kids, and the kids love them. And so we needed places for kids to see parents in a safe way, that we knew it was safe, but they still had that contact so they could maintain that relationship and that bond. And we had a supervised parenting time program that's been gone for several years, but also the supervised centers that are privately available, we've had a reduction in the number of those, and they are just swamped. We have got a call from one of them, Perspectives, about a month ago, that they aren't even taking intakes anymore because they're so full. So we know that kids need to see parents, and we're looking for safe ways to do that, and that's been impacted by the overall budget problems. Parenting education classes, this has been, I know, before the legislature in the last few years. I think that all of us who work in the courts agree that they're really helpful and important, but funding for those has been difficult also. There's an online program that's available. I've never done or seen the online program, but I know that the in-person programs were really helpful to people, and the loss of funding for those kind of things has hurt people. That's where we get people.
Representative Scott has a question.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And now it's escaped me because I was thinking about focusing on the parenting education. What was the point you had before that? Supervised parenting. Isn't there a task force right now that's working on that, making kind of a uniform set of standards for that? And secondly, can parents still, can they like go to a YMCA or somewhere like that and have supervised parenting there as well?
Judge Redick.
To these private places.
Yes to both of those questions. Yes, there is a task force, but the task force is not really related to the budget issue. It's just related to setting standards,
right.
So it won't really impact whether there are supervised places available. It might impact, I think, more who is available to do that, and they're working on that. And I've seen some drafts of that and given some input to that.
Good.
So they are working on that. Yes, certainly people can go to YMCAs, things like that. That's the majority of what probably we do. I know people think that most of the people are at a center, and that's not true. The centers have very little capacity, and the centers are two-hour time slots. Typically once a week at most is what you can get in. So that's not very much.
Mm-hmm.
And we usually use those really for only the most difficult cases where there's really a serious concern about the child's safety. So most people are doing it with friends and relatives, and you know, God bless these people who are willing to volunteer to assist families and friends to just be along to assure safety and comfort of children. We do, a lot of cases are more monitoring, where it's maybe that we just have some concerns about safety, but they don't rise to the level where we need some kind of supervised center. Or we have comfort issues for the child. Maybe they haven't seen that parent in a long time, maybe never. I mean, we have these cases where we have kids who are, you know, 4, 5, 6, whatever, and they've never seen that other parent, and that other parent is now, for whatever reason, asserting a request for parenting time. So there are a lot of different ways we do things. Without much money, we have to be creative, and we are.
Thank you.
Chemical dependency and mental health assessment and treatment, again, not just publicly but privately, those resources have really gone away. We used to have a lot of places that did sliding fee scale mental health, sliding fee scale chemical dependency treatment. We're seeing fewer of those, and they're harder for people to get in. We see people who are waiting to get into treatment, and you know, we want them to get into treatment because we want them to be sober so they can see their kids, and they're waiting. They're trying, but they just can't get in. There's no space for them. Custody and parenting time evaluations, again, we're really fortunate in the 4th District that Hennepin County, the county board works with us to provide some of these services. I don't know that any place else in the state still does. Maybe Ramsey has a little bit of capacity for that, but again, that's where the cost comes in for people. If they need an evaluation, it's tremendously expensive and very hard to find people to do it at a reasonable cost. There are a lot of people out there who would do it, but most of us don't have $10,000 to get a custody evaluation done. The guardian ad litem program, too. The statewide guardian ad litems are, in my opinion, just a wonderful group of people who work really, really hard, but they are bursting at the seams with the referrals that we make to them. Some of the other challenges are more in terms of what we deal with and who we deal with. Minnesota has a big immigrant population from many different areas of the world. So we have really, I think, are interesting cultural and language issues, but they are challenging. We have, it's hard to have a trial when you have interpreters in two different languages, one for each party, and the parties don't even speak the same language. That's a long, complicated trial that costs a lot of money, number one, to have the interpreters sit there. The interpreters are quite expensive. We're very cognizant of that, and we work really hard to resolve a lot of issues ahead of time, but if we have to have a trial with interpreters, that's tremendously expensive. Also, as I'm sure you're aware, people from different areas of the world have very different cultural norms. So it's sometimes pretty difficult to get them to, number one, understand American laws, Minnesota laws, and number two, reconcile that with some of their cultural practices. A good example is the Southeast Asian communities sometimes have cultural marriages at younger ages, and that's not recognized here. But of course, they have children, and then we have custody and parenting time issues, or they sometimes marry later, or sometimes don't. And similarly, from the African nations, you know, we have a lot of cultural marriage, and we have to deal with the result of that. They've been married. In their mind, they're married, and in the Minnesota law, they're not. So we have to deal with that. We have a big increase in never married parents. Our family law laws were written when most families were the Ozzie and Harriet families, a really traditional family structure, and we have much less of that now. We have a lot of never married parents, so those parents are challenging because many of them have not lived together or not lived together very long, have not had much of a relationship themselves sometimes, and so sometimes there is no basis built for trust between those parties. Well, if I don't trust somebody, I'm usually not sending my four-week-old with them, right? So those are really challenging cases for us because those people have never had an underlying relationship or basis for trust that we can build on to make co-parenting work very well. And we have a lot of work to get them to that place. And because of the lack of resources, we frequently don't have the ability to do that very well. Third-party custodians. We have a tremendous increase in cases where maybe grandma or some other relative or even just a family friend is willing to parent children where their parents are not available for, you know, the reasons we are all familiar with. Sometimes the parents are in prison. Sometimes they're chemically addicted. Sometimes they're mentally ill. Sometimes they're physically violent. A lot of different reasons, but we have a tremendous increase in those kinds of cases. And we have some interplay with the juvenile courts there in terms of children who are in need of protection, but someone else is available to parent them. And those cases take a lot of time, more than a typical custody case. Assisted reproduction technology, surrogacy, test tube babies, things like that. Minnesota laws are not designed to, or haven't been redesigned to keep up with where technology is. Again, not surprising, that stuff moves so quickly that it's hard for us to deal with those. I will say on that issue, I don't want to say we make it up as we go along, but we've really kind of taken the minimal framework that's in the law and kind of try to build a process as best we could for those kinds of cases. Same-gender parents, again, Minnesota law doesn't recognize same-sex marriages, but they do happen in other states, and there are same-sex relationships where people have children together. So we have custody, those kind of issues to deal with, but we don't really have a good framework in terms of our law to recognize those issues. So in some ways, our laws don't reflect our current society, or at least they haven't, they're old enough that they haven't been updated for us to deal with those. And again, we sort of just, we do the best with the law framework that we have and try and fit these cases in. I would say that I do this frequently, and I would invite any of you, if you would like to come sit a day in family court or a couple days or a week, we would love to have you. I'd be happy to be available as a resource to anyone who just has general family law questions also, but the people who come and kind of do a ride-along in family court, I think have a good understanding of what we do from doing that. So thank you.
Thank you, Judge Redding. Are there questions from members of the committee for Judge Redding? Judge Redding, I think this was the first time I can remember in civil law committee where we had a family law matter and there aren't one or two people with cameras filming it at the time. And I don't exactly know why that is on any particular occasion, but there is a substantial amount of frustration with results that are yielded out of family court, naturally, because, like you said, someone or both parties are usually upset about the outcome. And they resort to oftentimes trying to change policies. So thank you for coming. Regardless, we really appreciate it. It's very important that members who sit on this committee have a good grasp of family law from the top-down policy level and not necessarily just what's brought to you on an ad hoc basis about problems that need to be fixed. So we appreciate the offer of the judicial ride-along, Judge Redding, and we will send your information out around committee members. It is in your presentation, but we appreciate you coming down.
Thank you.
There being no other matters before the committee on the agenda today, I would note that the next meeting is Tuesday, February 12th at 8:15. Civil Law Committee is adjourned.